Okay, I thank you all for your patience. I know that we'll have other members joining us as time goes on, but I think we should start in the interest of trying to keep as close to schedule as we can. I'm Brian Becker. I'm co-chair of this task force representing the 19th district. And I just quickly, if everyone could quickly, I just identify themselves, go around, press the button on your microphone, and just brief.
Shelley Davis, Hartford Federation of Paraprofessionals, AFT, Connecticut.
Bob Namnum, the Connecticut Education Association.
Deb Richards, the Regional Education Service Centers.
Michael Regan, President of Connecticut Council of Administrators of Special Ed.
George Raphael with Connecticut Conference of Municipalities.
Jonathan Steinberg, State Representative, 136th District, Westport.
Terry Wood, State Representative, Norwalk Darien.
I'm John Filchak with the Northeastern Connecticut Council of Governments.
Jody Harkins, special ed teacher in Fairfield.
Thank you. I also want to let folks know that my co-chair, Michelle Cook, will not be here this morning. She had a death in the family this week and is actually taking her mother to the airport. Her mother's in from Missouri to help out this week, and is she's taking her back to the airport this morning, so she's unable to be with us, but we will keep her apprised of what transpires. Also, I just wanted to let you know that if folks have materials that they want to share with the committee members, that they can always send those materials on to David Desjardins, who's supporting us. His contact information is on the website, and David will collect and hold the material. We're not going to just distribute it. We actually had a couple of reports that went out early, and we're, now that we're getting our legs under ourselves, we're trying to create a little more order here and handle things in an orderly fashion. So we don't want materials on a variety of topics just being passed out here and there when there's no context for it, and we're not ready to address it. As you know, we've identified a number of issues that we want to address, and there may be more as we go along. So as these materials come in, David's going to hold them, catalog them, and when the topic is before us, he will send them out, these materials out in advance of the meeting that which we will discuss the various topics, so that we can kind of stay on course and not have a scattershot approach. So I just want to make that clear to everyone that that's how we intend to handle things going forward. And all of those materials will be posted to the website either at the same time or closely following the time that they're distributed to this group. Also, we've heard from a lot of folks asking for additional parent advocate membership on this committee, and the co-chairs are looking at options for that, and we hope to be able to address that issue in short order. With that, I'll turn to Terry Wood and ask if Representative Wood, if you'd like to make a comment or two.
No, but let's get started. Thank you, and great recap.
Thank you. The next item, I'm sorry.
We have a new Attorney Klebanoff. Would you just like to briefly introduce yourself?
He was here last time.
Oh.
Oh, that's
good.
Patrice McCarthy from the Connecticut Association of Boards of Education.
Thank you. The next item on the agenda is approval of the previous meeting minutes. Does anyone have any corrections to those minutes? I just noticed an article missing, and I'll pass that on to David. It doesn't matter. It's a the, so no big deal. So with that, can I have a motion to approve the minutes? Seconded? All right, all in favor? Aye. Opposed? Minutes are approved. Thank you. So with that, I will ask Pat Anderson from the State Department of Education, Bureau of Special Education, to come up. She's our first speaker today to give her presentation. Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, just a point of personal privilege. I would like to thank the members of the commission and its staff for the kind condolence card it sent my wife on the death of her mother a few weeks ago. It was deeply appreciated by her and by me. Thank you.
And once again, sorry for your loss, and thank you for that. If you would turn off your mic. Thank you. And now I'll turn it over to Pat.
Thank you. Can you hear me okay? Good morning, everybody. I work for the Department of Education in the Bureau of Special Education. I'm in a unique position. It's a split position where I'm paid 20% through the Bureau of Rehab Services and 80% through the Department of Education. And my unofficial title is State Transition Coordinator. So that's what I'm going to be talking to you about today. And you all should have a PowerPoint. If not, I think there's some in the back corner. So let's see if this works. All right. So this was a slide that was shared with you back when Gail Mangs and Maria Snowdy came and talked to you about IDEA and special education in general. And so this is the group of students that I'm going to be talking about, the ages of the students. Certainly you know that students can be educated through age 21 until they've graduated from high school, whichever is first. So secondary transition deals with students who are age 16 through 21. And the way we focus on students staying in school until 21 is until they've reached the age of 21, which is turn 21 in their last year of school. So school year is defined as July 1st through June 30th. So any student who turns 21 in that year can remain for that full year or until they have achieve a regular high school diploma. So that's how we define that. When we're talking about secondary transition, we first want to look at small transition and what transition is, because we all transition all of our lives. Students transition many times from preschool to kindergarten, kindergarten to elementary school, to middle school, to high school, and then finally out into the adult world. So when we take a look at secondary transition, or transition actually, I usually share this slide, particularly when I'm talking to families, and these are what we call the keys to success. Things like family involvement, social skills, independence, responsibility. And these are not things that can be teach a student at age 16. So transition really needs to be addressed as early as possible, even preschool, in developing some of these skills so that when they get to be age 16, we can address the secondary transition needs. So while I'm talking formally about students who are age 16 to 21, the whole concept of transition really needs to begin much earlier. So formally, transition planning is looking at three primary areas. It's helping students and their families create a vision for the future. And in reality, that's what high school is all about. We don't go to high school to get a high school diploma. We go to plan for our future. So the three areas we're required to focus on are post-secondary education or training, and employment are the two mandated areas, and independent living or community participation is an optional area depending on the individual student. So we like to talk about transition planning as the answer to the question, what do you want to do after high school? Because with the answer to that question, whether it's I don't know, or I want to be an NBA basketball player, or I want to be a doctor, everything else should be kind of fitting into place with the answer to that question. By definition, transition is not a program. It is a coordinated set of activities throughout the child's high school career. It must be results-oriented, which goes beyond just obtaining a high school diploma. We're looking at both academic and functional achievement. So functional meaning what can they do in academic areas and non-academic areas. And we're trying to facilitate a smooth movement from school to post-school activities, which must be integrated and inclusive as much as possible, and base all of this planning on the students' needs and strengths, but also their preferences and interests. So secondary transition is one of the was 20. It's now 17 indicators that the Office of Special Education Program measures us on, and we then measure districts. But there really are two that address secondary transition. Indicator 13 is what I'm going to be talking about today, which is secondary transition. And it is a compliance indicator, which means every district must have transition goals and objectives for every student who is age 16 through 21. Not 99%, but 100%. Indicator 14 is the other transition indicator, and it looks at the post-school outcome survey. All states are required to survey special education students 1 year after they exit high school to see where they are in terms of competitive employment, post-secondary education, and other adult agencies and so forth that they're working with. That is not a compliance indicator, but it is something that we do on a regular basis every year starting in July. So I'm not going to be talking about that, but I wanted you to know there were two indicators in terms of secondary transition. So this is, in layman's terms, what IDEA says about the requirements of secondary transition. These are the components that we look at to see if a district is in compliance and a student is receiving the transition planning that they're obligated to receive. So it talks about students who are age 16 and above must have an IEP that includes appropriate measurable post-secondary goals, which in Connecticut we call post-school outcome goal statements, that are annually updated and based on age-appropriate transition assessment. So the three components to that piece are measurable goals, post-secondary goals, annually updated, and based on age-appropriate assessment. They are to include transition services, which can be courses, it can be activities, it can be conferences, it can be work experiences, but those services will help the students meet their annual goals and hopefully their post-school goals. The other two components that were added into our compliance mix about 4 years ago were that we must invite every student to any kind of a PPT where the transition is being discussed, whether they're wanted there or whether they want to be there, everyone must be invited. And we must have evidence from the district that they consider inviting an outside representative from an outside agency or a participating agency to that planning and placement team meeting. The intent of that particular component is not to have a body sitting in a meeting, but to bring in information so that the goals and objectives that we're developing for the student are reality-based in terms of what they're going to be facing after high school. So we've been encouraging districts to get information, even if it's not appropriate at that time, to have a representative from the outside agency there so we can begin planning for that transition to that agency if that's appropriate for that child. So this is how we word it. When someone says, when does transition start? And, of course, I like to think it starts as soon as possible. But it begins with the IEP that's in effect when the child turns 16. So that technically means the PPT meeting where a child is 15 is where transition goals and objectives should first be developed. But in many high schools in the state, they actually start transition planning in grade 9. Regardless of what the age of the student is, because it's much easier to keep track of starting in ninth grade, which means that you then have to educate the eighth grade teachers about what transition is, because that's where those ninth grade IEPs get written. I think the rest of the items there I already mentioned. This is a brief flowchart of what secondary transition looks like in Connecticut, and you'll notice that in the middle of the big circle is career path, and that's because everything we do in transition should be helping students to move towards a career path or some kind of employment, even if it includes going to college. So we're looking at transition assessment and career exploration, writing appropriate goals and objectives, and then around the outside of the circle are all the different support services that students may need from the community, from the school, from adult services to be able to meet those post-school goals when they transition to adult life. The one other plan that I wanted to make sure you were aware of, that although it is not part of secondary transition, is the Student Success Plan. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but several years ago we passed legislation that mandated that all students in grades 6 through 12 had a student success plan. This is a general education plan, so it's for all students, including students with disabilities. It addresses academics, career, as well as social, emotional, and physical development. It's to be a student-driven plan. It's to be guided by counselors, adult mentors, community members, and parents. It gives students experiential learning opportunities for work as well as the opportunity to take college courses while they're in high school. So as you can see, while secondary transition is required to start at age 16, with the student success plan, students are going to be doing some type of transition planning, in quotation marks, starting in sixth grade. So that by the time we pick them up in ninth grade, they should have kind of a head start, at least on thinking about where they want to go in terms of a career path. One of the areas I know that you wanted to know a lot about was outside agencies, and I know that we have representatives from the Department of Developmental Services and the Bureau of Rehab Services here today, and I wanted to focus on why that is such a critical piece of secondary transition planning as OSEP looks at it. First of all, special education is an entitlement program, so students who are struggling are entitled to be identified and identified as having a disability if that's appropriate. Adult services agencies and programs are eligibility programs, and so a student has to qualify for their services. So there aren't as many services, and not all students will qualify for those services. So that's why the transition services in secondary schools are critical, because the capacity of the adult systems cannot support what school districts can support in terms of getting students prepared for careers and life after high school. That being said, it is not the LEA's obligation to provide transition services, because the adult service agencies won't work with a student until a particular age or with a particular disability. So everything has to be based on a case-by-case basis for that individual child. Yes?
Just for clarification for someone who, what LEA stands for.
Sorry. That's local education authorities, the school districts.
Thank you for the record.
So there are two primary reasons for agency participation, and I would just like to clarify that when I say agency, it's not just adult service agencies like the state agencies, and I'll give you some other examples in a minute. But it begins the referral process to those agencies if the student would be an appropriate candidate for the services of that agency, so that that process, they can go right to that agency as soon as they receive their diploma, and we're not starting the eligibility process once they've graduated. And also to get the expertise of those state agencies and outside agencies who can help inform the development of the IEP and provide better goals and objectives for the students. So this is just a list of some possible outside agencies. It could be post-secondary education, vocational education, independent living. It could be therapists, life coaches, job coaches, any number of individuals who are not employees of the school district are considered outside or participating agencies. Part of the reason for secondary transition is to help students and their families understand the difference between the legal legislation that protects their rights as individuals with disabilities. And this is just a brief summary of under the IDEA. Pretty much, it's a free and appropriate public education. We serve all students with disabilities. There are programs, accommodations, and modifications. There's a lot of parent advocacy. When you move into the Americans with Disabilities Act in Section 504, it's civil rights, non-discrimination legislation. They're not entitled to anything but non-discrimination and equal access if they are a qualified student with a disability, and they have to become their own advocates. So part of what secondary transition is all about is helping students to transfer from that IDEA special education system into the adult world where you're looking at ADA in Section 504. So one of the things I like to talk about when I'm talking about secondary transition is that we as educators need to look at everything we do through a transition lens, whether it's a reading test, a vocational evaluation, or an after-school activity. It all should be moving that student towards their goals for after high school. And this is true for all students, but particularly for students who are on special education services. So I wanted to give you an example very quickly of what a post-secondary goal would be. And we, as I said, in Connecticut, we call them post-school outcome goal statements. There's two criteria. The goal must happen after high school. So it's what I call a big umbrella goal. It's not a goal that's to be mastered before the student gets their high school diploma. And it must be measurable. It cannot be a process. So this one, the fall after high school, Anita will enroll in courses, non-degree at the local community college. It says that it will happen after high school. And it is measurable. You can measure whether she enrolls or not. Whereas if I said, Juanita will explore going to college. You can't measure will explore, so that would not be an appropriate goal. After finishing high school, Alex will increase his work hours in the business department of a local office supply store, contacting an agency for employment support services. So this is a post-school outcome goal statement in the area of employment. Again, it says it will happen after high school, and it's something that we can measure. We also have what we call combination goal statements, where we can combine two or more of the areas that we're looking at, and this is one of those. So Carol will independently attend culinary training at the XYZ Center after exiting from high school so that she can obtain entry-level employment within the food services industry. So this covers all three of the transition areas that are required, so it would be listed three times in a student's IEP as their post-secondary goal or post-school outcome goal statement. And then each of these goal statements would then have one or more annual goals that would go along with it, which are designed to move the student in the direction of this larger goal, and those annual goals do have to be met on an annual basis. So this is the big picture, the answer to the question of what do you want to do after high school. So this is just a visual model of how we actually go through that process of providing an age-appropriate transition assessment, which gives us information to help identify goals and objectives. It's really the career selection process that probably everybody in this room went through. What do I want to do? What do I need to do to get there? Is this a good match for me, yes or no? If it is, you move forward. If it isn't, you go back and look at other options and opportunities. So that's kind of the cycle of transition planning that all students would go through when they formally start it, and probably a good portion of them in that student success plan would be going through the same kind of process, but not quite as formally. So there are a couple of additional issues around transition planning that I think are critical if you're going to understand the whole concept, and that is that it must be a student-driven process. The student's voice is very important in this process, and it must go beyond the kind of career and academic activities that are provided to every student in the high schools. Most students in the high schools receive some kind of career preparation, career exploration, usually around their sophomore year, and many of them go through college selection between sophomore and junior years. And we do want to include our students with disabilities in those regular ed processes, but specialized instruction and secondary transition cannot be just those areas that other students are receiving in general education. We also look at time with non-disabled peers, meaning that we want our students to be 80 to 100% with their non-disabled peers, which is typically not a big issue while they're in high school, but I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the services we provide for students who are 18 to 21. And for those students, their peers are not within a high school building. And if they were in a school, in a program, in a high school building, most likely they would be only with their disabled peers, so they wouldn't be with non-disabled peers. So many of these programs are out in the community, and we'll talk about those in a few minutes. The other thing that we realized and why I've encouraged districts to start their transition planning in ninth grade is because there are some districts in our state, we have 169 districts more or less, 143 that have secondary school programs, and if you have a district that does not have a designated high school, in other words, they are just going grades K through 8, they really need to do the thinking about their career path when they're selecting a high school, which could include the technical high schools, in eighth grade. They can't wait until they choose a high school, and then transition planning starts in ninth grade. So this is another area why I've encouraged districts to start transition planning in ninth grade instead of waiting till age 16. One of the other areas that we address in secondary transition is helping families to look at what happens when the student turns the legal age of 18. And we have some new special education regulations that were passed as started and went into effect as of July. And there were a couple of new areas that were added through that legislation, which families need to be aware of. This usually is a topic of discussion at least at the PPT when the child turns 17, letting them know the responsibility for their education will turn over to the student at age 18 unless one of these other options is explored. The most common and simple option is for the student who's 18 to write a written statement indicating that they give their parent or other adult their permission to act on their behalf educationally. It is simply signed and dated and kept in the student's file. The new other piece of legislation that was added is the Board of Education can appoint an educational representative. And then, of course, there's the other legal routes of power of attorney, guardianship, and conservatorship. And particularly for students who have more severe disabilities, these conversations actually need to start well before age 17, so the family has a chance to kind of think these things through and decide which direction they want to move in. So one of the tools that we've developed through the department, I have a 42-member transition task force that's been in operation since the late 1980s. That advises the department on transition issues have come up with a list of 12 core transition skills, no relation to Common Core state standards. And they are the 12 areas that we feel that all students with disabilities need to master. And certainly, for example, the first one is to assist with the development of their IEP. Would look very differently for a student going off to college than it would for a student who has difficulty communicating verbally. But we feel that all of those students can master these goals to the level that they're able to master. So this is something new that we are promoting with all of the districts to actually use these core transition skills as their annual goals for their students in secondary transition. So the other piece I wanted to talk just a little bit about are the services that we offer for students who are 18 to 21, and also what we informally call a fifth year or a bridge year. Connecticut has about 20 to 25% of all special education students who've completed their academic credits towards graduation who continue on for transition services only. This is at the request of the planning and placement team. Sometimes it's a joint decision. Sometimes it's a request by a parent. Sometimes it's a district decision. And they bring the parent and the student along. So what these services look like, as I said before, many of them, we have about 40 or so, are based in the community at colleges, four-year and two-year schools. They're in organizations. They're in storefronts, apartments, houses, church basements, any place that a district can find a location out in the community. There are even two communities that have what I call programs without walls, where the students are picked up every day and each day they go to a different location. The bottom line is they're working on the same kinds of things in terms of transition planning. They are working on functional academics. They're not working on coursework because that's been completed. They're also working on vocational experiences, career exploration, community participation, transportation issues, and other independent living skills. Some students are in those programs until they're 21, if that's what the district decided when they entered ninth grade. Other students may, in their junior or senior year, they may request from the PPT that they're not going to meet their transition goals by the time they graduate, and they're looking for additional transition services to be successful once they finish their academic credits towards graduation. A few of those students may only need a summer or a semester or a year, and those are the students that we call, that we say are kind of in a fifth year or a bridge year type of program. They just need some additional concentrated support and transition services, and then at any point in time, they or their family can decide they want to take their diploma and move on to adult life. And all of these situations are determined on a case-by-case basis through the planning and placement team. So in general, what transition planning is helping students to look at all of those components of their lives, not just the academic, certainly the vocational, the career paths, independent living. We look at healthcare issues and what kinds of needs the student may have and need to take care of on their own in terms of healthcare, to help them become a productive member of society, including work, future learning, and being a good citizen. The last thing I want to leave you with is that secondary transition planning is required under IDEA, but we are also well aware that our students are part of the general ed population, and there are many initiatives that are going on for those students. And so we try and align transition planning with whatever curriculum and content standards are happening in general ed. We are focusing on career and college readiness for those students, helping them with the student success plan and making sure that the student success plan is aligning with the IEPs, looking at standards-based IEPs, and then, of course, providing appropriate professional development, not only for the school districts and the families and the students, but also the adult agencies that we work with. So what we are really doing in secondary transitioning is helping those students transition to adult life and helping them put the pieces together of the puzzle together one piece at a time. Okay?
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
We have two other presenters this morning, so I think what we're going to do is allow them to present, and then we can ask questions of all three rather than taking it in sequence so we can try to get as complete a picture as we can. Thank you, Pat. So our next speaker is Jordan Scheff, the Regional Director of the State Department of Developmental Services. And he has some company.
I have some company, yeah. Thank you, Representative Becker. And I'd like to introduce Robin Wood, who's going to lead for me this morning. We didn't have a lot of notice in preparing for today, so Robin's expertise with the department goes far back behind mine and has some particular expertise in this area. So I'm going to allow Robin to go ahead.
Terrific. Welcome. Is that to be passed around?
Yes. And I...
It's one copy of a packet. We can make available those types of packets, as many as you need.
I see.
I'll send it to you
electronically to David Desjardins. That would be great. He could distribute it and put it up on our website as well. Thank you. Go ahead.
What I thought would be most helpful is to walk you through this packet to let you know what kinds of materials you might want to look at to best understand what we do for the department.
Just for the record, your full name.
I'm sorry. Robin Wood.
Thank you.
I'm the Director of Family Support Strategies and Advocacy at the Department of Developmental Services. Prior to that, I've worked in school systems and agencies, lots of different positions, primarily with focus on transition and employment. I'm also the parent of a young man with severe autism, 31 years old, who lives at home. So I have a very vested interest in all the good work that everyone's doing here. So a little bit of background, just so, again, you get to know what we do. In the packet is, and all of this information we'll send electronically to you. is just our mission statement. We do have a new mission statement with our new commissioner. The two things that have changed that I think relate most to the work that this group is doing is one is that we're really trying to have families and individuals have a stronger voice in our department, so working with them as partners, so that's a change we're trying to make in the department. We're also really trying to make sure that families understand what we do at a much earlier age. So we now have what we call our lifespan approach. Even though our services are primarily to adults, we recognize that the earlier families understand what we do, the earlier we start working with them and work effectively with school systems to help them to understand what we do, the better off families are going to be. So those are the biggest changes in our mission. And obviously, we're trying to change our infrastructure to support that new mission. So I think it's really important that you look at some of our mission statements and our vision plans and our five-year goals, et cetera, to understand the department. I also have a handout. We have a handout here about a PowerPoint presentation that just tells about what kinds of services we provide. So it will tell about our case management services, our residential services, our day and employment services, et cetera, and give you a little bit of background of the different ways we do business. There's a handout on eligibility. We are an entitlement service. Not everyone can get services from our department, so there's a handout that explains who's eligible for our services and how they become eligible. I thought that would be helpful. The primary work that's done that's focused on working with people who are in school systems is done by our transition advisors. We have 12 transition advisors in the department and 5 educational advisors. Those are the individuals that actually go out to the school systems and do work with school systems. Our 12 transition advisors work with people age 16 to 21. Our ed liaison advisors work with people usually age 18 to 15, that range. They can go lower, but that's the typical age that they work with. So there's a handout that talks about their role. It talks about, just transition planning and how we do transition planning in the department with our case managers and with those individuals. And then there's a number of different materials related to employment, because we have a department, as a department, feel very strongly that people who are employed when they graduate school or ready for employment when they graduate school are going to have much more successful lives. So we have a very strong initiative in the department that focuses on employment. Some of the things that we're working on with families is trying to help them to understand that if they start early and have high expectations for their child's going to be much more successful in that area. So we put together, I hope you all look at our employment success stories. They're videos of people who have been successful in employment and are doing well in employment, and it's a really useful tool to help families understand what's possible for their children. We also know that those children who have summer employment before they graduate are much more likely to do well as an adult and be successful. So helping families to figure out how to make summer employment and helping them to do that. We know that we can't just leave it in the school systems to get people jobs and help to get ready. It takes a team. It takes the village. So we have a fact sheet of what families can do, what individuals can do, what people in the community can do, what we can all do to work together to help move people forward to better expectations. And then the other thing we have is there's a lot of misunderstanding about benefits, Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare, et cetera. And the impact of those benefits on employment. People often think that they can't work, otherwise they won't get their benefits. That's not true. Connecticut does a very good job of helping to make it possible so that people can get benefits and still work. And so we've tried to work on developing materials to help people understand how to do that. We have a very strong relationship with both Pat Anderson. She's in lots. We work very closely with her and trying to make sure the two systems work together. We work very closely with Kathy and the Department of Rehab Services to try to make sure that we're working effectively with them. This is really important work for us in our department, and it's really important that we do it well. The last thing that I hope that you look at is we have a new website that we've developed for families. If you go on that website, it gives families, and we heard complaints from families as we try to partner with them better, that our website is hard to find information and hard to understand, so we organized a section on our website just for families. It's divided into those lifespan ages, so they can go to a certain age and find certain information just for that particular age. And we're hoping that that's going to help families, again, prepare and be in a better position to use our services as they move their children along the lifespan. We have an MOU with the Department of Rehabilitation Services. That MOU requires that we meet at a central office level twice a year. It requires that we meet as regional offices, so we have regional meetings quarterly at all five of our regions, all three of our regions. I'm showing my age here. They meet, they talk about what's working, what's not working, how do we make it more effective, et cetera. We've recently worked with Pat to develop what we call a lifespan committee, so that we have people who represent all of the lifespan ages, both in the school system and in our school system. And that focus is really, again, how to help people to think about employment at a lot earlier age. Because if we wait to 18 or 21 and start talking to families and start talking to individuals about, wow, we'd like to see you employed when you're an adult, that's a pretty late start. And so we're trying to think about how can we do work differently so that people are thinking about it at a much earlier age. I'm sure that there's other things that I should have mentioned, and Jordan will pick up whatever I missed.
I just want to share a couple of comments that, given the financial constraints in the state over the last 8 years, the department had to face difficult decisions, and at a time a few years back, our ability to assign case managers to students who were already eligible for services but still active in their schools was greatly diminished, as well as our ability to fill certain positions. In the last year, we have gotten quite a bit of relief there. So we're restoring both staff and positions related to transition that in prior years had been eliminated or at least held for refill. So there was a bit of a bottleneck for us that we're beginning to unopen now to address those needs. We have, however, received grad and age-out money, is how we refer to it, allocations from the state to work with those children as they come out of high school and into our services. Although that's been delayed at times, sometimes we don't get that money until October as opposed to July 1st or even later. We have received that every year, and we appreciate the efforts of the state to give us that money to address the needs of those students graduating.
It was great. I'm just a little baffled as to why you didn't bring the PowerPoint to project it, because it would have been easier to follow all the information.
We didn't know. I didn't know until yesterday that we were going to be presenting. I thought we were coming for questions and answers, so I didn't know until about 4:30 last night that we were actually expected to present. So that's why there's
okay.
No PowerPoint.
Well, that water under the bridge. A number of things in here look very helpful. So if it could be sent to us, and I guess we'll just rather than...
Yeah, we would. We'd be very happy to send it to all and come back to present if you would like.
What you're doing is wonderful work. And could you, rather than send the video, just send a link that we can
have
watch on our computer?
I don't know if we have the video on the website yet.
Yes, we do.
So we can send a link to the videos.
Because that would be, it would save the resources.
Everything in this packet, we have a link electronically. We will send
it. And if any of our esteemed colleagues around the table would like to utilize those videos and have a DVD available to use in presentations in the work that they do, we have lots of copies of videos like that, a couple different years worth highlighting different people. We'd be happy to make available.
Great, thank you.
Yeah, I think we'll need to have you come back, because this is a lot of information really fast, hard, kind of difficult to follow. You referred to a lot of things that are in papers that we don't have before us. This is one packet, as you said, and I understand why. So I think we'll probably take you up on that and have
Absolutely.
You come back again.
I would like to just...
But I would ask, if it's possible in a short amount of time, if you could at least, and I know we're trying to save our questions to the end, but if just to help us to kind of see the picture, we heard from Pat, and in a number of the things you were talking about with transition services, it sounds like there's overlap. Not quite sure how it all fits together. And so maybe you could kind of at least paint that picture a little better for us so we can hold it together before we ask Kathy to come up and speak and then and help us so we can figure out who we should be asking questions of when the time is appropriate.
Sure. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Becker. I first want to clarify or just emphasize a point that Pat made in her presentation that the adult services are an eligibility-based service, not an entitlement service. So everyone going through school who has an IEP or belongs to special ed doesn't necessarily end up receiving supports or services from our department or the Department of Rehab Services. And they can speak to their piece of that. There was a time where we did a lot more outreach at a younger age, and we're beginning to restore that now, as I suggested. So the overlap used to be, I think, even greater. There's been a huge effort, and I think Robin referenced about 17 staff that we have that work with 140 school districts to help transition a lot more kids than 140. So our ratios for being able to get connected and stay connected are a little tough, although they're improving. We've recently received permission to hire additional case managers, which will help with that. I concur with Pat that transition starts somewhere around the age of 3, not the age of 13 and not the age of 18. But it's very hard to do that, and there is some overlap of work between the Department of Children and Families, Department of Social Services, our Autism Division, our division, and the Department of Education. And sorting out some of that is sometimes part of the challenge. As to who's responsible for what, and Representative Becker and I have had that conversation in other venues a couple of times recently. So that is how we try and connect. We try and identify students in the system that are likely to become ours and begin our outreach as early as we can. That got dialed back a few years ago. We're beginning to dig a little deeper and connect a little earlier. There's some outreach work going on, piloting right now in the South by my counterpart, the regional director in the South, beginning to meet with LEAs, the local educational authorities. In the South region, I'll begin to be doing the same in the North and my counterpart in the West to sort of update where we're at. There is a big disconnect between what parents think is going to happen at 21 and what is actually available to happen at 21, and trying to make sure that our educational partners are on board with where we're at and what our opportunities and constraints are.
Okay, great. If we could ask you to turn back. Thank you.
And thank you very much.
Kathy Marcioni, come up. Thank you. Kathy's the Regional Director, Bureau of Rehabilitation Services. If you could just identify yourself for the record. Thank you.
Yes, I'm Kathy Marcioni. I'm the Director of the Western Region of BRS, and I oversee autism services. I hope I understand why I was asked here today. I'm not completely clear, so if you don't mind, I just want to make sure I'm making the right comments that are useful to all of you. Brief overview of what BRS is. Do you need that? Yes? And also, I was asked to talk about the EOP program and ongoing supports. Is that correct?
EOP being?
It's an ongoing support program for people who are in support employment.
But EOP stands for?
Employment Opportunities Program.
Great. Sure.
Both? Okay. Briefly, BRS is the Federal Vocational Rehabilitation Program. We are 80% federally funded, 20% state, and our job is to help people who have disabilities to get and keep employment. We serve a very wide range of individuals, but our focus is very, very narrow. So we serve individuals who have any disability whatsoever, except for legal blindness, and in this state we have a sister agency who serves those individuals, the Board of Education Services for the Blind, who provides the same services we do. We are an eligibility program, as was mentioned, and if you think sort of the continuum of disability legislation, where we fall in terms of who sort of makes the cut into our program, if the widest door open is the Americans with Disabilities Act, and the narrowest door is Social Security Administration, we're sort of in the middle. So we are eligibility. lots more folks get our services than would be eligible for Social Security, but a whole lot less are eligible than are covered under the ADA or are served under IDEA. So that's kind of where we fall. We provide services to help individuals get work. In terms of transition, we ideally like to meet students when they're in their second to last year of school. So as a junior, if they're graduating in a four-year program, or when they're 19 or 20, if they're finishing at 21. We do have counselors assigned to all the public schools in the state, but it is a high schools, but it is a small part of their job, so there is a capacity issue there. But every high school on our website is listed what BRS counselors connected, so they know how to reach us, and we do partner closely. The issue that has been sort of a hot-button issue lately has been this ongoing supports in our EOP program. A part of our federal funding is called Support Employment Funding, and lots of different human service organizations use that word with slightly different meanings. In our program, it's federally defined as someone who will need ongoing support on the job for the life of the job, and it may be a very small amount. It may be one or two times a person to stop by and check on them in a month, but that we have reason to believe at the beginning of the job that they're going to need ongoing support. That's different than the vast majority of the individuals we serve. When that is the case, we are required, again, by our federal legislation, to know who's going to provide that ongoing support before we place the person in the job. Otherwise, we are setting the person up for failure. So we partner with DDS all the time. They provide that ongoing support. The Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services provides it for people who are eligible for that program. And we have a small pool of money called EOP, Employment Opportunities Program, that we can provide that ongoing support for individuals who are not eligible for either of the other of those two state agencies or don't have another resource for that. The reason this has become a big issue recently is because when the autism waiver passed, and it has a very long waiting list, everyone who's on that waiting list is no longer eligible for our EOP funding, and so there are some people caught in that gap who can't now get services through us who used to be able to because they are technically eligible for the DDS program. Right. So a number of your colleagues are working with our departments trying to sort that out.
Okay, thank you. I guess with that, I'll open up to questions, and I would ask all the speakers perhaps to come up to the table, grab a couple extra chairs so that you're near the mic and can respond as questions are asked. So we'll give you just a sec to do that. And questions? Howard.
This question would really probably apply to all three of you. As I hear you talking, it seems that there's a tremendous blanket that is available to cover children as they're entering the transition area. However, from my experience, and this has been discussed for years in Connecticut, the federal law requires interagency agreements, which basically puts the responsibility on the school district to identify the child's needs and services, but then the law goes on to say that the school district doesn't have to be totally responsible for those services, that the various state agencies, you know, also have a responsibility to share in that. I have never seen a meaningful interagency agreement that's been adopted in Connecticut which would really coordinate all the services you're talking about. Because in cases I see, and I have many involving transition kids, particularly the children with more severe disabilities, there are meetings where BRS is not invited. There are meetings where DDS isn't invited. Children are sort of pushed into a transition services, the more disabled. They don't have a say in what they should get. They don't have a say in what kind of independent living skills they really need, what their vocational interest in. It's often their parent who's going to be the advocate. and the parent doesn't know anything about a lot of your services. So I have two questions, really, and I'm sorry for the dialogue. One, has an interagency agreement been effectively developed, and if so, can we get a copy of it? Two, the other thing I would ask is the federal law requires that parents be informed of their rights, and it's a very strict provision in the federal law. There is nothing in state or federal law that requires parents of, or, you know, basically children entering the transition program to be informed of all the opportunities you say. Should there be a provision that requires school districts, as the children reach the transition age, to be fully informed of the various opportunities that are available for transition planning? I have so many parents who contact me. Their children are being pushed here or placed there. I've seen goals written for a child with, say, severe autism on an independent living skill need, that the child will successfully learn to navigate the community and cross the streets 80% of the time. So what is being done to really have school districts inform parents of these opportunities so that children don't flounder? And I know it varies district by district, and Pat, I don't know if you've made assessments of some of the different districts that may need help or not. I'm finding that it's basically the less affluent districts that really, or the smaller districts where there's little opportunity for various employments, that really have the problem. But parents are often floundering, and what you're talking about, it seems, would give them ample information to start pushing the school district to work in partnership to involve the various agencies you represent where appropriate.
Okay, first of all, I think there were like five questions in there, Howard.
Probably.
The one that I can answer is there is a formal agreement between BRS and the State Department of Ed, and that just came up at our recent RSA site visit. So I will ask Kathy to track that down and get that over here to you. No. No. Part of the issue for that is most of the adult service agencies do not provide services to students who are still in school. That has always been the predominant responsibility of the school, at least as this state has perceived secondary transition. There are a few other states that have slightly different models, but that has been, the collaboration has been there, but not necessarily the services, although there are some services, I would say probably in all of the state agencies, that are provided to students who are still in school on a case-by-case basis. In terms of your question about informing parents, there are many, many different avenues that all of us have used to inform parents. One of the issues is that sometimes families don't think about transition until the student's in their last year of high school or next to last year of high school, and all of a sudden it's like a deer in headlights. It's like, oh my goodness, what am I going to do with my child after high school? I spend hours and hours and hours on the phone talking to families. It is an extremely overwhelming topic, and they can only take in so much at a time. And I think the opportunities available to any individual student are so vast that you can't inform every parent about every opportunity for every student. It would just be too much information all at once. In our partnership with the State Education Resource Center, we have a regular parent training program on transition, which we go out to districts for free and do parent trainings, nights, weekends, have been doing that for a number of years. We have over 40 presenters who are both parents and professionals who have been trained to go out and do these presentations upon request. We work very closely with the Connecticut Parent Advocacy Center in terms of doing presentations and print materials and having information available. Certainly, we have publications on the website. Building a Bridge is one of them. There probably is room for districts to spend a little more time talking about transition, and I think moving the awareness of transition, whether it's a capital T or a small T, into the middle school and even into the elementary schools will help families understand that transition is not just that thing that happens when a student turns 16, although that's the more formal portion of it.
Pat, what I'm concerned about, though, is just what you said, that many districts don't start training a child or working with a child on transition until the senior year. And I would never expect that the parents would be given all of the overwhelming information you have, but what I'm wondering is if it might not be productive to have parents get a simple fact sheet listing the various agencies so they are informed and can start talking with the district about whether this agency or that agency should be involved. They don't even know, in many instances, that there's a potential requirement that various agencies be invited to the appropriate PPTs when transition is being discussed. And I think some kind of sheet like that would make things work more smoothly and not have the contentious situation develop where a year or two down the road the parent is suddenly panicked. As you said, the child's, you know, suddenly going out. What happens? Where do they go? How do they do it? So I think there's a gap there that could be addressed and worked on.
Well, interestingly, we have a new document. It's called Easing into Secondary Transition. It was a collaboration. It was a result of a collaborative grant between BRS, CERC, and the RESCs. It has a contact person for transition for all of the RESCs and all of the state agencies, and it has a listing of the kinds of services those agencies provide in terms of secondary transition. And that is available and has been posted, I believe, on most of the RESCs website and the state agencies' websites. So there is some information that is becoming available. That was just, I think, finalized in the fall, maybe, early fall, Deb. So we are working on those kinds of materials as well as to expand the capacity of the RESCs, for example, to be looking at transition and beyond in terms of adult services more and provide support to both the districts and the families. So we are working on some of those skills, and I'd be happy to send a copy of that to this committee.
Thank you.
I just would like to offer a thought on one of the other comments you made. As the person receiving individuals at the back end of transition in our adult services in the Department of Developmental Services, the affluence of the town doesn't always equate to better transition. I think it's the priorities within the town and the staff and their training in those school districts, the superintendent's commitment to those individuals with special needs has as much to do with the success of their transition as the tax base.
I far from disagree with that, but I think what happens is in a lot of the more affluent towns, parents are often more informed and have information that is often not available to some of the, you know, families in other towns.
Robert.
This issue, Bob, please. This issue of transition for all students is, I thought that was the basis of the formulation of the SSP at grade 6. So is it your impression that with the formulation of that change, that transition for special ed students would be discussed at least beginning in grade 6?
Yes, and that's why I mentioned the student success plan, because it was the reason for the development of that plan was because all students really need the same kinds of process that we go through for special education students in terms of looking at careers and making sure the academics match. I mean, I remember hearing an engineer talking on a NPR one time, and he said if a student hasn't taken Algebra 1 by eighth grade, they've missed the sequence that they need to be prepared to go into engineering. So a lot of these things need to really happen before ninth grade. And each district is at a various, a different level in terms of the student success plans. We've done a lot through the department in terms of helping districts align those student success plans with all the other plans for students with disabilities, the IEP, 504 plan, individualized healthcare plans, so that students, we can't replace any of those other plans because they're legal documents with a student success plan, but they certainly can be combined. So yes, your intention is correct. It should be starting as early as sixth grade to be starting to think about some of these areas.
Just as a follow-up, does the department have any capability of ensuring that districts are creating those SSPs at grade six?
It's part of a larger plan. It's not something that's formally monitored like we do with IEPs and special education. But there are people who are working in that area and going out and working with districts. There are supports through CERC and some of the RESCs in helping the districts to develop those student success plans.
Joe.
Hi, my question is for Pat. How many students are involved in the secondary transition? Do you have in Connecticut?
I should know the answer to that because it goes out with our, I would say, I can get that number for you, but okay. I don't want to quote it off the top of my head because I may be wrong.
Okay. You also stated there were 42 members that you had that assist.
42 members?
I'm asking.
On the transition task force?
On the task force. And that started in what year?
Somewhere around 1989.
And they transition the students?
No, the transition task force is an advisory committee.
Okay.
Of all members of all the state agencies, the rest, transition coordinators, directors, parents, advocacy groups. And they work on various projects and advise the Bureau of Special Ed around secondary transition issues.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification.
Deborah?
This actually is for Robin and for Jordan. And, I appreciated, Jordan, your forthright comments about the challenges of DDS over the last few years and cuts and having the availability of transition staff to get in earlier than 18, 19, 20. That's been a huge frustration, as you know, both for DDS and for the LEAs. I think it would be helpful for the committee to understand how challenging that last year is for a family tied to the state budget, that you're sitting there waiting for a student who's graduating on June 20th, and until the state budget passes one, you don't know if there's going to be money for that student. And even when it passes, you don't know when that money's coming. So as much as you hope it's July 1st, it could be October, it could be November. And from a family's perspective, all of a sudden you're sitting with an individual who needs support, who may have no support for many months. And that unknown territory is really stressful for parents. So if you could just comment on that.
It's not just stressful for parents, it's stressful for us. We have had some success and pretty good success in the last couple of years that not knowing that committing dollars earlier than they're being awarded and taking them from other places. But when you are in a pressure cooker system, when you put pressure one place, it bursts, percolates up somewhere else. So when we're shifting those dollars around, because the gap that you're talking about, if someone graduates on the end of June with their other students and then doesn't get supports from us until October, lots of things can go wrong in 4 months, and all the work that the LEAs have put in over 20 years or 18 years, you can take giant steps back much more quickly than you can sometimes take small steps forward. So we try and figure out ways to bridge that gap, particularly for our most vulnerable folks. It's one of the reasons that Robin and I and the state have worked really hard to work with the LEAs to identify jobs even before they graduate, because even if we're not able to support them, at least they have something coming out of school. It is a challenge. There's also been a change in expectations for families, and if they haven't been paying attention to our system, there was an expectation that you'd get a 5-day a week 9-to-3 program, or 9-to-4, what the LEAs provide in terms of coverage for working hours for families, particularly working families, is a lot different coverage than we provide. That's often a shock to the system as well. And as they learn that, as the child's aging out, trying to figure out coverage needs for morning or afternoon are additional challenges, not just where they'll spend their day, but how they'll support that person at home, both morning and late afternoon while they're at work. So it's a, I don't know that that anxiety starts necessarily in their 20th year. It may start much earlier than that. We're fortunate to have some really good advocates and parents who have lived through that and have come back to work with families to educate them that they shouldn't wait till age 20 to worry. They should start worrying now, regardless of the age. Did that help answer the question?
I think it just helps to round up the significance of the problem from both GDS's perspective and certainly the LEA's perspective, who do feel that, okay, we've invested all of this, we're ready to go, and then potential slippage in abilities for individuals.
I think in addition to all of the problems identified, we end up providing people with more costly services than they probably need, because we're not able to inform people about all of their choices and what's going on and, what they can do differently and more creatively. I also really want to emphasize the, when I got into this position a year and a half ago, we had 4 people working on transition. We didn't get new money to move it up to 18 people. What we did was those individuals transitioning from birth to 3 positions, we created new positions for them. When I started in the department 12 years ago, we had 6,000 employees. We have less than 4,000 right now. So we've got people in our services who are aging and who are living longer, so we're having a bigger group of people. We have more people being diagnosed with disabilities and more people coming into our system, and plus we have a number of people who are needing more services because we haven't been able to add to the system. So we've been really pleased that we've been able to make some of the changes and work with people and try to meet some needs despite all of those challenges, but we really feel that that's why our focus is on trying to do things and meet with families earlier, so that we can help them understand their options and do some things differently so they're not in that crisis situation. The 2-year cycle of funding for our graduates and waiting for the budget to decide whether they're getting funding or not and not knowing until the last minute is a huge problem.
I think it speaks, I mean, this is wonderful information because it speaks to why we wanted to form this group, and it's important to know that difficulties you all are experiencing in the trenches. So thank you. And I think we also do want to do it now. Okay.
More questions, Dan? Go ahead. Betsy.
Yes, I'm trying to understand the costs of these services to the municipalities and the school districts. I know, Kathy, you mentioned that your services from your agency are 80% federally funded and 20% state funded. Are there costs to the district? Because I'm not clear on that.
No, we're an adult service agency. The towns and cities and school districts don't pay anything.
Is that true of all
the burden's on the local education authority for the funding of those services through 21 for the most part. What we provide, we get different funding than what the LEA uses. So when I assign a case manager to work with someone through transition, that's coming out of our funding, not the LEA. Does that answer the question? I'm not sure if I understood the question.
Yeah, I wasn't sure because I thought some of the transition services the school district was responsible for absorbing within their budget. But
yes, the school district is responsible for paying off for almost all of the transition services until a student receives a regular high school diploma or ages out at 21.
Right. And then at what point do you know that that student or those students are going to be eligible for those additional transition services
to an adult agency?
One of the concerns that towns raise is that the costs of special education are very unpredictable, and I don't know whether or not they have to identify or that you determine eligibility prior to their adoption of the budget.
Certainly discussion in the planning and placement team meetings or with the families about what services are available to them once the student exits high school can start at any time. Typically, it starts at a minimum no later than the next to the last year before the student is exiting, unless they have a more severe disability, and then the conversation probably needs to start earlier. While we may start with the adult agency, the eligibility process, they're not actually receiving services or getting funding from those, so it would not impact the costs for educating a special ed student for the municipality. Those services would be in addition. And on a few occasions, an adult service agency like BRS, for example, might work with a student during a summer towards, like, right at the end of their school career, but that's on a case-by-case basis and not a very frequent occurrence. And that is totally funded through the adult agency. It's not a cost that's passed along to the municipality.
Yeah, you know, I don't know if it would be helpful to understand the pilot project we did a year or two ago. It was a very brief, very simple project that we did with a couple of school districts, BRS and DDS, working with a very small number of students who were in their second to last year of school. And really, to simplify it, each party put a little something extra on the table than we normally would be able to do under our existing sets of rules in the name of the pilot to help. The goal would be to have these 9 individuals who were DDS eligible and BRS eligible to be able to graduate with the job that they would stay in. Now, and what we learned after doing this for a year and a half and following these small number of students was that the main barriers that we faced were what were mentioned earlier, that families were not prepared, which is understandable, that these jobs were not Monday to Friday, 9 to 5 for the most part. It might be Thursday afternoon, Friday afternoon, and Saturday night. And that was a hard commitment to make as a family, understandably, and transportation. Yeah, so that was in a nutshell a lot of our learning.
I just lost in the mix a little bit today is another partner that we have all been working with a little more closely, which is our partners in industry. For those of you not familiar, Walgreens, as an example, has a project to really encourage an inclusive work environment and has built specific programs to include not just folks eligible for DDS services, but DRS and certainly people who come through the school system. And that is one of the ways that we are all looking to create additional opportunities and additional transition opportunities for folks needing supports.
Great. Thank you. John?
Earlier, Pat, when you were giving your presentation, you talked about, I think it's indicator 14.
I'm sorry?
Indicator 14.
Yes.
For the outcome survey. And am I correct that you look at 1 year out?
Yes.
So that's the only window that we look out to see whether it works or doesn't work. Or is it, are you? I'm trying to understand, how do we measure the success of what you've done? Is it?
That is the
1 year seems to me to be awfully brief.
That is the primary window that all states are required to look at, which is 1 year out. We have on the table the desire to look more longitudinally. There is also a longitudinal database that's coming down the pike where we will be getting data from higher education, for example, looking at some of our students who are going on to higher ed. So there will be some additional data that's available in the not-too-distant future. So but right now, this is the only vehicle that we have to look at that, yes.
So we have no data that 5-year, 10-year,
no.
Et cetera, in the state. Also, you mentioned, I guess, this list of all the agencies that mm-hmm. could potentially be involved that the RESCs have. Are we talking a dozen, two dozen? What's the universe?
The agencies? We're talking 4 or 5 predominant adult service agencies, Bureau of Rehab Services, DDS, Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services, Bureau of Education Services for the Blind, and I think that's it. No, I said, didn't I say DMS?
Department of Labor, Workforce Boards.
Those are not considered adult service agencies. They are certainly state agencies that provide services to adults and includes adults with disabilities. And we certainly inform school districts and inform families of the services that the Department of Labor, particularly in their Connecticut Work Centers, offer. But that's available to anyone. There are some that partner very closely with schools, and schools bring students there so they're familiar with that. The BRS counselors certainly do that in their communities. But that's not a state agency that provides the same kind of services as the other adult service agencies do.
Thank you.
I just want to follow up on John's question, because you mentioned and you emphasized the fact that transition services are results-oriented. So it was curious to me that you skipped Indicator 14, the post-school outcome survey, that you didn't address that. I'm curious as to why.
Predominantly because I was informed that you wanted to understand secondary transition. If you want more information on Indicator 14, certainly all of those reports are published on our website and posted on our website. The two issues around that particular survey is that we have a very high percentage of students who are employed and going on to college, but the problem is the response rate for the survey is probably about 20%.
See, that's very interesting, because yesterday there was a presentation over at the LOB, and there was a national consultant who was there who emphasized the fact that this is really all of these things we're doing are really supposed to set folks up to be able to live independently, to be able to be employed, et cetera, et cetera. And he talked about the wide gulf between those without disabilities and those with who are employed, and the tremendously higher unemployment rate for those with disabilities. So the fact that you say that many go on, I'm guessing that the percentage of those many is still much lower than
it
the
is.
General population. And so it really calls into question then, you know, what we're doing here, how much we're doing, how effective it is. And that's why I think it's very important, to John's point, to be looking, and as you said, you're going to try to look longitudinally, look over a number of years. But there apparently is data out there, and you know, would love to get your help in finding that data more specifically, that will demonstrate the fact that we're not as successful as I think we would all like to be in helping these folks.
There is a national study. It's called the National Longitudinal Secondary Transition Study that has been looking and following students in transition for, I want to say, close to at least a decade and a half. So they have some national data on the success of students who are exiting high schools and going into colleges and going into the workforce.
And is that national data broken down by state?
I would have to look. I'm not sure.
Okay, well, I appreciate getting that information from you. You could follow up and
send
it on
to
David. That would be very helpful.
Do you want to address?
I'm sorry. Go ahead. I'm sorry. We'll get
just a quick question. Believe me, I know, I think, the struggles of the agencies, whether it be from funding or other issues. But all of you talked about early involvement, becoming acquainted with the student, the way that could keep costs down. And yet I've had directors of special education tell me that, as the law requires, when the child turns 16, at PPTs, where appropriate, the representatives of various agencies should be invited. And that way, representatives from your agencies get to know the child at an early age, how the child's progressing. Sadly, and I don't know, and I'd like to hear you respond to this, is it because of lack of staff, lack of funding? Sadly, in so many cases, I'm told when the PPT is held that, Howie, we invited the representatives, they declined to come. And I'm wondering why or what standard is used by you to determine whether you accept that invitation to come, which gives you an ample opportunity to determine whether this child would be covered by your agency or what the child's needs may be, and you now start having a path that, you know, could be followed.
I mean, I can answer that for BRS really clearly because we don't have anywhere near the staff to attend every PPT for every 16-year-old and up. Our transition students are, if I had to guess, I'd say maybe 10 to 15% of each caseload around the state, and we have 75 caseload counselors. So, you know, if you look at the number of kids, it's not possible. So what we, I mean, as directors, what we tell our staff is, meet with the school districts at the beginning of every school year, review who they have without using names, you know, because we don't have permission, and prioritize how to meet these families, how to meet these kids. Most of the time, our counselors sitting through what could be a very long PPT, which probably doesn't involve us for most of it, is not the best use of their time. So what we ask them to do is meet with the special ed directors or guidance counselor, however each district works, and prioritize who they have that year and meet with those families and students individually. So we have a wide range of schools that are able to do that.
Yeah, Kathy, I sat on your board years ago, and I know the problem, and I would never expect representatives from your agency to or any agencies to attend the thousands of PPTs that are held across the state. I'm talking about only those where the district itself identified that these children have the potential to be served by one of your agencies because of the severity of their needs. And you know,
exactly. Those would be the kids that we would want to be hearing about in the fall. And certainly we do go to the PPTs when it's somebody that we know who the case is already open, number one. And number two, unfortunately, when they notify us ahead of time, because what does happen sometimes is we get a call 2 days before, here's the PPT and it's already scheduled, and our counselors probably have counseling sessions all day. So that does become a barrier too.
All right, and it's also been said for DDS that DDS many times are told by one of your local regional offices that we don't get involved until the child's 18, so we're not going to attend.
I think, again, with our new commissioner, that's one of the things that we're really happy with, is that we're saying a new message that we do want to get involved earlier, and that's a very big change and a welcome change for many people in the department. I do have to emphasize, though, that shortage of staff. One of the reasons all of the materials are in your pamphlets and what we've tried to show you is because we have so few staff and bodies to go out there. We've concentrated our efforts on trying to get materials into people's hands because that's our next best plan. That's the best we could do without the bodies. So that's where we put a lot of our energies. Again, 2 years ago, we had 4 people working on transition. 4. We're thrilled we have 17 now. But 17 is not very many. We also used to have, you know, Jordan mentioned, we used to be able to provide case managers at an earlier age. A few years back, we had to make cuts, and as a plan B, we established what we call as our helpline, so that those families that would have gotten case managers early at least have a phone number to call, and again, developing materials to give people. But even though we'd like to do a much earlier intervention, much earlier contact with people, we've actually cut back on our bodies to do that work. So our plan B has been trying to reach out and be on committees and partner with people, and so we're at least communicating and working together effectively and developing materials that we thought might be useful.
Thank you. Terry?
Thank you. Good. Thank you for that information. And this is a very global question. A couple of you mentioned eligibility versus entitlement program. Is that something you could answer briefly right now, or does that... Okay, thank you.
Mine's really brief. A person to be eligible for BRS has to have a disability that's a barrier to employment, and that
this is the entitlement or eligibility?
This is BRS eligibility. They have to have a disability that is a barrier to employment, and that they require our services. We have a presumption that they can benefit from the services, except for in the most extenuating circumstances. We have no financial means test. That's not relevant. And if someone comes to us without documentation of their disability but believes they have one, and we have reason to believe as well, we will get the documentation that we need. We will provide testing or evaluation.
Thank you.
For the Department of Developmental Services, eligibility as stated seems pretty easy. It's a little more tricky when you get into the details, but the three criteria are: you have to be a resident of Connecticut, have a diagnosis, have mental retardation as defined in Connecticut General Statute 1-G, or provide a medical diagnosis of Prader-Willi syndrome. And that's a simplified version of what it is there. The measure in that statute allows for more flexibility than just those three criteria.
And then entitlement program is IDEA. IDEA. All right, great. Thank you very much.
Okay, I'm just taking a look. You got a quick question, Mike?
Yeah, for the eligibility requirements for DDS, we've always struggled with that. There's a gap between what qualifies a kid for DDS services under the old term mental retardation versus what school districts have in terms of intellectual disability. The state statute for eligibility for mental retardation has real severe cut points. And oftentimes kids that we have identified as intellectually disabled miss your cut points by 1 or 2 points and are disqualified from services.
My clinical director in the North region has been spending a year and a half educating me on this particular definition. There is a line based on IQ number, but the IQ testing has a standard deviation to it, and so the eligibility office at Central Office has been able to stretch that debate based on a person's functional ability, which isn't always measured by intellectual quotient. The eligibility sheet that you have in your packet, I'll come back to your question in a minute, is from 2007. We have since actually got the statute changed to read intellectual disability and not mental retardation, but what you'll have in your packet, we'll try and update before you get it, but that's from 2007. The statute since changed to reflect the change in terminology. So there is some latitude, but there is a huge gap, particularly we have recently in the last few years been able to push through two federal waivers for autism, which captures another group of people that wouldn't otherwise be defined under intellectual disability that the schools will define under intellectual disability based on pervasive disability disorder or autism. But it's a separate waiver and it's a separate entrance into our system.
I guess the issue is that the statute that exists right now for eligibility for DDS is really outdated. It's not even in line with what the eligibility requirements for intellectual disability for Social Security are. We're all in line. Social Security and the school districts are in line with what that criteria is. And it's really, instead of 69 IQ and adaptive behavior below that, it's really up to a point of 75 with some variability within there. So we capture a lot more kids. But it's the experiences of the LEAs that it's not been as flexible as you just described, because we've struggled sometimes with, you know, a point, 2 points on IQ where kids were not eligible because of that.
And I would just
and
ask
my guess
if
is Howard Jordan, to talk before, a lot
before,
more.
Before you speak, just we heard earlier that different programs have different levels and that some are between others and we've got this end and that end and we're somewhere in between. If you could perhaps provide us with kind of a map of where they fall and what, and perhaps put the boundaries of where that criteria is, and to your point that if there have been changes, sort of how the lines might have gotten a little fuzzy or where the stretch might be, to try to lay it all out for us so we can see it kind of in one picture, because a picture's worth 1,000 words, to kind of lay it out for us. And I've heard similar types of things. You know, children with autism who are above a 70 oftentimes will not be eligible, for example, for transition services, is my understanding. But I think it would be very helpful to this group to see a sheet that would kind of lay that out. And I think that would probably go a long way to addressing Mike's point, and we can, you know, continue the conversation from there.
One of the challenges our department has is in our focus to be better meeting the needs of families and being a more lifespan approach is not confusing families about what we can and can't do. So, you know, we are an adult service agency. And if we, you know, part of the hesitancy on some of the part is, if you open the door too much, we're not meeting the needs of the people that we're already serving very well. You've heard that from lots of families, et cetera. People are living longer. People are getting diagnosed. We're serving lots and lots of people. So there is some hesitancy about opening the door too much. there is a hesitancy about when we talk about the lifespan approach, that doesn't mean we're going to be able to serve people who are 4 or 8 or whatever, that we're just trying to help them to understand their choices, understand some things that they could do ahead of time before they get to us to be in a better position to use our services.
Right. Appreciate the point. I think we just want to understand where things stand, and then we can try to evaluate from there, taking into consideration things that you just mentioned. So that being said, our hour is growing late. So I'd like to thank you all for coming in for your presentations. And I also want to apologize to the extent that instructions were less than clear, and we will endeavor to do better in the future on that. As far as our next meeting is concerned, it will be in late March. We're going to hold off announcing the exact date at this point, and it is the intention that it be the private special education service providers. That will be the topic then, which goes to the what you were saying. So we'll take that offline. Okay, right now?
I was going to ask, at the last meeting, it came up about private placement. I was just going to ask if I could file the documentation that has the federal rules and everything for the State Department with Dave.
So yes, Howard, I believe you came in, perhaps you came in later. I announced at the beginning that we'll take documents and information that people want to share at any time. You can give it to David Desjardins or send it to him, but we're going to hold that material until shortly before the meeting on the topic so that we are not doing a scattershot approach where different issues are being circulated at different times and, you know, people are spending their time reading things that we may not be speaking about for some time and try to keep some order to the process. So by all means, give that to David, and he will have it, and he can get it out to the group in advance. It'll also go up on the website, so everyone else who's following can do this. So thank you very much for following up. Appreciate it. Terry?
I just want to mention as well, apologies. We're trying to get this organized, and I guess it wasn't clear that a PowerPoint and a small handout would have been great. But, again, apologies. But thank you so much for your time today, and I certainly learned a lot, and I think we all, this is our opportunity to learn. So we really appreciate your time and all the information and your dedication to this effort.
Bob.
Yes, at the last meeting, some of us requested some information from the speakers there. Do you know if any of it's been received by you or Dave?
I'm looking at David, and he's nodding his head up and down, so I guess it has, and I think it'll be getting out shortly. David?
We have received some responses from the State Department of Education. I just received them this week, actually, so it's been a busy week, but it will go out today. Thank you.
Okay, and so with that, I think we are adjourned. Thank you.